Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you are about to give before this committee will be the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do, so help me God.
From Washington, NPAC presents the Senate hearings on the confirmation of Nelson Rockefeller to be vice president. Tonight, a special summary report and assessment. Now here is NPAC correspondent Paul Duke.
Good evening. This has been another busy week in the life of Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller. For 3 days, he underwent questioning before a congressional committee which is weighing his fitness to be the 41st vice president of the United States. And even though that fitness was challenged by some witnesses, there seems little doubt the Senate Rules Committee will approve his nomination. Mr. Rockefeller has been a prominent figure in American politics for many years. He has had a hand in formulating many major government policies. He is widely known abroad, and he is better known to most people in this country than the man he will serve under. For most of the past 16 years while serving as governor of New York, Mr. Rockefeller has pursued the presidency himself, but each time something went wrong and the golden prize eluded his reach. At the 1972 Republican convention in Miami Beach, he ironically shared the spotlight with Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. It was, in fact, Mr. Rockefeller who made the principal nominating speech for his old political enemy when Mr. Nixon was tapped for a second term.
I say to you, delegates, and to you, my fellow citizens of America, we need this man. We need this man of action, this man of accomplishments, this man of experience, this man of courage, this man of faith in America. It is my great honor to nominate Richard Nixon for re-election as the next president of the United States. Thank you.
Now, by a strange twist, the departure of Richard Nixon has meant a political rebirth for Nelson Rockefeller. And after an absence of 20 years, he has returned to Washington to be the junior partner in the Ford administration. It was the old, smiling, jovial Rockefeller at this week's Senate hearings, a Rockefeller who showed no regrets at taking the number two job, a job he once vowed never to take. The country, he said, faces critical problems, and if he can help, he is only too glad to do so. Public television covered the Rockefeller testimony in its entirety. Tonight, we will focus on the testimony of others who either endorse the nomination or oppose the nomination. In the process, we will also closely examine the Rockefeller record and assess that record. We also will offer some interesting insights into what kind of vice president he will be, assuming, of course, that he is confirmed by Congress, and some disclosures about how President Ford may make use of Mr. Rockefeller. To help in this task, we have with us Richard Reeves, a correspondent for New York Magazine and longtime Rockefeller watcher, Alan Campbell, Dean of the Maxwell School of Public Affairs at Syracuse University and a former Rockefeller consultant, and David Broder, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. In the final 2 days, 27 witnesses appeared before the Senate committee to testify. They included members of Congress as well as representatives of various organizations. Most of the public witnesses opposed Mr. Rockefeller's nomination, mainly on three grounds. One involving Mr. Rockefeller's wealth, a second, his liberal views on abortion, and the third, his handling of the Attica prison tragedy in 1971. During the Great Depression, Americans used to talk about being as rich as Rockefeller, but nobody has had a real peek at the family fortune until this week. Mr. Rockefeller submitted figures placing his personal worth at $62.5 million, but with income from three trusts, total net assets come to about $180 million. In an age of billionaires, this was lower than many people had anticipated. and in fact under what a number of other leading U.S. tycoons possess. It also was surprising to some that more than 50% of the Rockefeller wealth consisted of works of art. The other big items include 20% of securities and more than 17% in real estate. For many people, there was one shocking disclosure that Mr. Rockefeller did not pay a penny in federal income tax in 1971, mainly because of large deductions, including $1.25 million in contributions to charity. Despite all this, Mr. Rockefeller went to great pains to play down his affluence, suggesting it was a myth that he and his family wielded great economic power. On Thursday, however, his critics repeatedly disagreed.
And from 53 to 65, the Southwest was cleared, the small businessmen were kicked out, 23,000 blacks and 23,000 people, 70% of them low-income blacks, were kicked out. And in his place, instead of the subsidized housing at $17 a room or less, which was the promise under which this land was taken, we see today a $100 million Rockefeller complex. Now, the Congress and the administration, the White House, and everybody else said that they'd never make that mistake again. And the local government swore the same thing, but we have in Washington, in downtown Washington today, an attempt to displace all the businessmen in the Pennsylvania Avenue area. And in the West End area, there's another project which apparently has Rockefeller backing. It's backed by the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States, which we understand has four directors from the Chase Manhattan Bank on it, and David Rockefeller was chairman.
Now, first you refer to the Chase Manhattan Bank. We have a list of Mr. Rockefeller's assets. He has no interest in the Chase Manhattan Bank. That's his brother David. You refer to his brother David here, and you also refer to the brother Lawrence. Are you suggesting that that Mr. Nelson Rockefeller should be disapproved by this committee because you don't agree with policies that have been taken by the Chase Manhattan Bank or by the Equitable Life Assurance Society, incidentally, which Mr. Rockefeller has no assets in either, according to the sworn statement that we have?
Well, I would make this point. The Washington Post, in an article which I have attached, says that Nelson Rockefeller does have an interest.
Well, the Washington Post isn't a witness here and isn't here under oath, and we have a sworn statement of the assets. We have had a thorough investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We are having an audit by IRS and by the Joint Committee, and that fact is not borne out so far.
Well, Mr. Brown may wishes to speak to the point, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to speak to the point. I think all along it's Nelson Rockefeller we're talking about in the foundation. It's not the family we're talking about. And in the ethics of a legal conflict of interest, one should not take a position on anything that affects him personally or his family. And the obvious fact that the Rockefeller brothers themselves set up a foundation called the Rockefeller Foundation amongst the brothers themselves show that they at least speak to each other. The impression given here now is that Nelson Rockefeller doesn't speak to the brothers, doesn't know what the brothers are doing, and has no interest. And I think that basically we should look into all the assets that they hold together, because to get the true pictures, and the assets they hold together are vast. And the assets of Lawrence Rockefeller, David Rockefeller, and John Rockefeller, and the rest of the Rockefeller empire have not been brought forward. I think, and anybody else in American politics, they want to know if appointing your brother was nepotism or, it's always been a family relationship, except in this case. They're supposed to be total strangers here now.
In a sense, what's happened is the Rockefeller interests, or the cabal which the Rockefeller dominate, set up the oil price hoax last year and are setting up a new oil price hoax this year. Through this, hundreds of billions of dollars of capital accumulation from the advanced sector and the underdeveloped sector is being concentrated in the hands of those financial institutions which control this wealth. Therefore, we may say, in effect, that the net available allocable capital, the liquidity of the world's financial system, is being concentrated through this oil hoax and related measures in the hands of banking interests dominated by the Rockefellers. Through this, existing industries are being depleted. Entire areas of industrial development are being wiped out. And oil recycled dollars are being deployed to what are called regional development projects, such as the Rio de la Plata project in the Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay region. that whole sections of the world are being destroyed. And the investment limited through control of these financial masses to gasification projects, Rocky Mountain energy projects, similar types of projects, destroying large sections of the population and leaving investment only for those sections of investment and development which are in the interest and are proposed by this cabal. I say that the discussion so far, focusing on how much Rockefeller owns, is unimportant. Rockefeller is not some small manufacturer or small speculator who is attempting to use government office to aggrandize himself personally financially. That's not the issue. The Rockefeller family represents a political group which is committed to carrying out a political policy on a world scale. They are not concerned with stealing dollars for themselves personally. Their policies are aimed at taking over the entire world. And therefore, what Rockefeller Nelson owns or what he doesn't own is absolutely irrelevant to the point.
We must view Nelson Rockefeller as part of an integrated family empire, and we must evaluate that financial empire not only in terms of its dollar and cents worth, but in terms of the control it exerts across national boundaries, penetrating the inner circles of our government and those of other nations. It is impossible and misleading to separate Nelson Rockefeller from the international web of the entire Rockefeller family. That family, whose fortune originated in the era of the robber barons with the development of the Standard Oil Trust, has a virtual stranglehold on this nation's economy. Consider that the Rockefeller family controls, not owns, but controls 25% of the assets of the 50 largest banks in this country and 30% of the assets of the 50 largest insurance companies. Through its control of the Chase Manhattan Bank, First National City Bank, Chemical Bank, and First National Bank of Chicago, as well as New York Life, Equitable Life, and Metropolitan Life Insurance Companies, the Rockefeller family exercises the dominant voice in this nation's economic life. Giant industrial companies dependent upon financial institutions for short and long-term credit are tied to these financial institutions through a web of interlocking directorates, holdings of the trust departments of these banks, as well as outright family ownership of large sections of stock. 50 of the 500 largest industrial companies in this country are controlled in this manner. The relationship between these companies and the large banks is much like the addict to the pusher. The companies are dependent upon the banks for their lifeblood, capital. Clustered around the Rockefeller financial complex are a host of companies too numerous to mention. Among them are the offshoots of the old Standard Oil Trust, Exxon, Standard Oil of Indiana, Standard Oil of California, Mobil Oil, and Marathon Oil, making Rockefeller by far the most powerful voice in international oil. The Rockefeller family controls the nation's second largest food producer, Borden's. Through its influence on banking policies determining the availability of credit and interest rates, which in turn regulate the availability of housing, the Rockefeller family has firm control over another aspect of our lives. How then does Rockefeller the man, perhaps even the president, separate himself from Rockefeller the financial institution?
How much money has Nelson Rockefeller and his brothers and family invested in IBEC and other overseas corporations, Mr. Chairman, set up there to use cheap labor and to avoid U.S. taxes? See, why has not Nelson Rockefeller been asked to reveal his or his family's connections with the Amtorg Corporation, which is a Soviet trading agency in the United States, and its business dealings with the Chase Manhattan Bank, which the Rockefeller family controlled? D, why has not Nelson Rockefeller been asked to explain to the committee the reported monopoly which the Rockefeller Chase Bank Group holds in connection with any American patents used by the Soviets? These, we feel, are most important questions. We feel that the favorable consideration of nominee Nelson Rockefeller by the Congress would amount to a national calamity.
Now, no member of our family is on the board of any Standard Oil Company, nor do we have representation on any Standard Oil Company's board, nor do we have any control over the management or the policies of these companies. I say this because I think that as these hearings go along, the myth or the misconception about the extent of the family's control in the economic life of this country, I hope, will be totally brought out and exposed and dissipated. I would like to now say about the family as a whole in the oil companies. Total family holdings, outright and in trust, all living members of my father's family, that's all of us. The maximum we have in any one country company is 2.06% of the outstanding stock. Now going to the Chase Manhattan Bank. I own no Chase Manhattan Bank stock myself. The trusts of which I'm a beneficiary own none outright, but as they hold a portion of the stock of Rockefeller Center, and Rockefeller Center has a holding in the Chase Manhattan Bank. But the total holdings of the family, outright, in trust, through trust, represents 2.54% of Chase Manhattan stock. Now, my brother is the, as I said, the chief executive officer of the bank. We do not discuss, and I have never discussed with him, the management and the operations of his bank.
To assure his nomination, somebody suggested Mr. Rockefeller would have to agree to putting all of his holdings into a blind trust and selling Venezuela besides. I would like at this point, though, to turn to our panel now, and specifically to Richard Reeves, and ask what your feelings were about the arguments that were advanced by the opponents to Mr. Rockefeller, Dick, and what impression they made on the senators.
Let me answer the second part first. I don't think they made any impression on the senators. But I think that they overstated the case as Rockefeller understated it. Rockefeller power is not a myth. And even if you accept his definition as a myth, power is what power is perceived to be. So if other people believe the Rockefellers have power, they will react to the Rockefellers as if they have that much power. But to say they want to control the world, as the gentleman from the U.S. Labor Party said, I think the Rockefellers probably learned their lesson. At one time, they controlled the distribution of petroleum products in the United States, and eventually the government moved in and broke it up, and they're not the kind of people who make the same mistake twice.
Do you agree, Alan Campbell, that Rockefeller power is not a myth?
Certainly it's not a myth, as the governor responded to Senator Byrd when he was pushed very hard on this, that they do indeed possess great potential power. The question is whether it will be used and how it will be used. And it seems to me that in relation to the issue here, which is whether he should be accepted as vice president or not, depends on whether you believe that he is likely to be more responsive to the major financial interests in this country, the dominant wealth in the country, or could one suggest that perhaps a person of less wealth would be likely to be more responsive? I'm not at all convinced that the fact a man possesses wealth means that he thereby automatically responds to the pressure from other wealth. In fact, he might be better able to resist it. So in that sense, there's no automatic relationship between possessing wealth and protecting it in a political power sense.
How do you feel that he has used his wealth? Do you feel that he has generally used his wealth for the public good?
Well, I think that's a mixed picture. He certainly has used it in part to get himself elected to the governor in the state of New York and has been quite successful.
To enhance his political power.
Yes.
He has used economic power then largely to gain political power, at least in one sense.
Yes, that's quite correct. He has used substantial amounts of his own money or his family's money in running in political campaigns. He also, as has been demonstrated by the information that's been revealed, has given very large sums to charitable foundations and to other cultural interests in which he has a great deal of, for which he has a great deal of concern. And in that sense, one could argue that he's had perhaps as much influence on art in this country as he's had on politics.
Well, speaking of his influence on politics, I'd like to turn to David Broder, the national political correspondent for the Washington Post, and ask you, David, does the fact that he is rich make him more attractive to some people?
Makes him more attractive to some people because they presume he would be less tempted to finagle or to steal in office. And since people now presume that most politicians will steal if they have the opportunity or the temptation. They figure by getting a rich man like Rockefeller in there, they at least cut down on the temptation.
Do you feel that in part, at least, this is a legacy from Watergate?
Sure it is. But there's also a negative side to it, which we ran into when we were out doing some voter interviews. And that is the expression that what can he understand about problems of an ordinary person like myself? So Rockefeller has certain credibility problems, I think, in terms of public reaction, just as he has a certain kind of built-in public assurance that he's not seeking the office for private gain.
He has occasionally slipped during campaigning for governor and used the phrase, the average taxpayer like you and me, which universally brings a roar of laughter out of any crowd.
It is also interesting about Rockefeller that he has always prided himself, despite his wealth, on having the common touch.
Well, he's a heck of a campaigner. He does not have the common touch. It's funny. I mean, that, to a certain extent, that's an act. He can go out in Coney Island and slap people on the back and do the Hiya Fella number. But, of course, at some point, he leaves Coney Island, gets on the plane and is back, and then the helicopter, and is back in Pocantico Hills with 100 guards surrounding a 6-square-mile property. So it's a, it's kind of the king coming out from behind the walls to touch the folk, I think.
Dick, what does money mean to Nelson Rockefeller?
I'll tell you, I don't know. I do know that, how can you evaluate how they feel about money? Like most rich men, as far as I can tell, he doesn't carry money. There's a story that's probably apocryphal. The last time he tried to make a phone call with no one making it for him, he couldn't understand why a nickel wouldn't work because he hadn't used it.
Well, it means one thing to him, at least up to this point in his political career. It means that if there's anybody whose talent you think will be helpful, you go out and you hire him. You don't hesitate to do that.
There's one thing on the whole economic thing. I mean, these people concentrated on family things as if they're going to try to make a couple of extra bucks for the Chase Manhattan Bank. In fact, what came out during the hearings was that Rockefeller's personal view of economic affairs is an old-line conservative Republican view of let's get the money into capital investment and that'll get things all right. And that seems to me to be at least as significant as what his personal interests are.
Well, there also were times during the 6 hours of debate when it appeared that the hearings would turn into a full-scale discussion on abortion. At issue was Mr. Rockefeller's role in liberalizing New York's abortion laws. Some speakers condemned his support for making it easier for women to obtain abortions. Others suggested Mr. Rockefeller had become the symbol of a new kind of immorality in the destruction of life. Both sides voiced strong emotional opinions.
My testimony concerns itself with the insensitive manner with which Governor Rockefeller dealt with the issue of problem pregnancies and his active promotion of abortion on demand and other forms of social killing. Prior to 1970, Governor Rockefeller handpicked a study commission mandated to recommend repeal of the state's protective abortion law, responding to what are now known to be totally unverified statistics on the number of women being killed by illegal abortions, the commission urged repeal to the New York State Legislature. In a razor-thin majority, it approved abortion on demand. In an unprecedented move, Governor Rockefeller journeyed from New York City to Albany on the following morning, a Saturday, to sign the bill into law. Within 2 years, the same legislature voted by a far greater majority to repeal this permissive legislation after the New York State Right to Life Committee waged one of the finest political lobbying efforts ever recorded in Albany, New York. Mr. Chairman, the man you are scrutinizing for confirmation for the second highest office of our country turned his back on the child in the womb. He turned his back on the elected representatives of the people of New York State, but more devastatingly, he turned his back on the democratic process. The veto by Governor Rockefeller of the repeal measure was vindictive by a man who was a bad loser. Realizing they were standing in defense of life itself, Right to Life advocates used every reasonable means of expression. They were then characterized by Governor Rockefeller in his veto message as, and I quote, the extremes of personal vilification and political coercion brought to bear on members of the legislature, end of quote. He saw them raising, and I quote, serious doubts that the votes to repeal the reforms represented the will of the majority of the people of New York State, close quote, when in fact this was the case. Mr. Chairman, I submit that no public poll was ever recorded in New York State, but I would be remiss if I didn't specifically mention the fact that within 5 months after Governor Rockefeller's veto, the states of Michigan and North Dakota held public referendums, at which time permissive abortion was defeated by majorities of 2-1 and 3-1, respectively. In view of these election results, I would judge Governor Rockefeller as guilty of misrepresenting the people of New York State in the gravest of human issues, that of life and death, and as such has rendered himself unfit to occupy the second most important position in our government of the people. The subsequent Supreme Court decision on January 22, 1973, which opened the doors to abortion on demand during the entire 9 months of gestation, was lauded by Nelson Rockefeller, who claimed that the Berger Court had totally vindicated his pro-abortion posture. And yet you gentlemen are well aware that the ultimate decision on the right to life will be determined by the people in the form of a human life amendment to our federal constitution.
He's been presented with all the facts of all the complications that went on in our state for the 2-year period. He knew that the death toll was increased from abortion, both illegal and legal. He knew that our teenagers were being mutilated. He knew that freestanding clinics had mushroomed all over our state with no supervision from either the city or the state. He knew all this, and yet he fostered his one opinion on all the members of our state, although our legislators were well informed of the complications, and that is the reason they repealed the law.
Mr. Rockefeller is perhaps the leading proponent of permissive abortion in the United States. He strongly supported the 1970 New York State law, which was then the most permissive abortion law in the country. When the legislature repealed that law in 1972, he vetoed that repeal. He is a strong supporter of the 1973 abortion decisions of the United States Supreme Court. It is fair to say that his nomination as vice president offers this nation a perhaps irrevocable choice between the pro-life and anti-life philosophies. The critical nature of this issue is sometimes obscured in the discussion of Mr. Rockefeller's nomination. However, I suggest that the committee ought to reflect upon the fact that a vote for his confirmation will be a vote to adopt the totalitarian philosophy of permissive abortion as the public orthodoxy of this nation. For better or worse, and without anybody's desiring it, this nomination has become, in effect, a referendum within the Congress on the issue of whether this nation is going to follow the anti-life or pro-life philosophies. And the reason for that, I suggest, is because if you scour the nation from one end to the other, you could never find a more committed, more prominent, and more symbolic representative of the anti-life philosophy that urges and affirms the position that innocent human beings can legitimately be defined as non-persons and killed for convenience. So it's there. The reality is that he is the nominee, and I suggest a vote for his confirmation is a vote for his policies, and it will commit the nation to those policies on these issues.
That's well, I would completely disagree with you on that last statement, because I want to assure you that if I vote for his nomination, just as I did with Mr. Ford's nomination, that is in no way an approval by me of all of the conceptual issues on which we may differ, and that would exist exactly the same in this case, because I disagree with Mr. Rockefeller on a number of issues, and I may or may not vote for him, but if I do vote for him, it certainly cannot be construed that I approve of his stand on many, many issues that he's taken. Senator Griffin?
I would agree with the chairman and suggest that the effort here to try to say that the vote on Mr. Rockefeller's nomination is a vote for or against right to life on this issue is not only
inappropriate, but I think that if and when Mr. Rockefeller is confirmed, you certainly wouldn't want the Congress then to take your position, because...
What I'm saying is that there's not a legal commitment in that sense, and I'm not saying, in response to Senator Cannon, that a vote for Governor Rockefeller is indicative of internal dispositions on the part of any member of the Senate or the House who votes in that direction. But what I am saying is...
I sort of read your statement in several places as saying almost exactly that.
Well, I think
and
that,
also that the government is somehow making a commitment by the vote on Mr. Rockefeller's nomination as vice president.
I would respectfully disagree with you. Well, I understand that you disagree.
We might approve Mr. Rockefeller's nomination and agree with you later on the very issue that you're talking about.
But I do maintain that position for this reason, because the nomination, in view of the nominee's prominence in the population control and abortion movements, has taken on a symbolic character which really cannot be ignored.
During the time that Governor Rockefeller was governor of New York, maternal and infant mortality rates declined precipitously, and so did the welfare rolls. And that's probably the first decline in welfare rolls that we've seen in a major city, a major urban center in a long time. And the basic problem, it seems to me, is that women always have abortions, and we always will get abortions. The question is whether or not they're going to be safe and legal. The Supreme Court has made abortions the law of the land, and I think that the people especially those who were here this morning and discussed the fact that they disapproved of any sort of abortion, really have to realize that any illegal abortions fall most heavily on those who are poor, because it's those women who are then not able to get any sort of state aid for medical care. It's those women who go to back alley abortionists. Middle class, affluent, upper class women like me or like Mrs. Rockefeller can always go abroad for our abortions, and we do. It's the poor women in this country who get butchered and who die of septicemia. And I think that the concern that the governor showed for what has happened in New York, that maternal deaths, especially for teenagers and older women, have declined because these are very high-risk mothers. And when they have abortions, you find that overall infant maternal mortality increases because they are such high-risk mothers. I'm also concerned about the groups that I saw here this morning, whom I have never seen in my 4 years of lobbying here in Washington, work on things like child abuse and child care legislation. I'm very concerned about what they're going to do after the first 9 months. And it seems to me that in the very restrictive and sometimes illegal amendments that have passed the House and the Senate since the Supreme Court decision, that you're really talking again about poor women. To cut off Medicaid funds or to cut off other kinds of funds for abortion in this Congress are really only going to affect the poor, because they're the only ones that rely on the federal government for their health care. And the idea that Governor Rockefeller had some identification with them really makes me feel that he is much more sympathetic. This is now the law of the land. And unlike the men, and they were men, who testified this morning about my compulsory pregnancy, I would not deign to force you, Mr. Chairman, or any of the men who testified, to carry a compulsory pregnancy to term. And I would not either force them to have an abortion. And I think that whatever one's personal views of the Supreme Court decision, it must be very clear on the record that that is now the law, and that there is no one forcing anyone to have an abortion, but they would force me to carry a compulsory pregnancy. And I think that if you talk about the values of human rights, certainly there is every reason to expect that those of us who have worked to make choice an option should have someone in the White House as vice president who really speaks to this.
The death estimate ran as high as 10,000 per year. Obviously, illegal abortion constituted a major public health problem. The restrictive laws were not working. In fact, they were compounding the situation by preventing women from obtaining medical help. No responsible public official could ignore the problem. Many tried. To his everlasting credit, Governor Rockefeller did not. He showed the strong sense of public responsibility that characterizes all of his actions. The real issue then was, and still is now, not whether there will be abortions or not, but where they will be performed and how they will be performed. So in 68, I think you're probably familiar with it, so I will skip through my remarks. The governor recommended a commission. The commission recommended reform legislation. Two bills were proposed and failed. During the debate on these reform bills, I became convinced, and incidentally, I'm the only woman Republican member of the New York State Legislature, and as you probably know, the Republicans are in the majority in both houses and have been all during this period. I became convinced that the problem of unwanted pregnancy and the psychological reaction of women was not understood by most of my male colleagues, simply not understood. They didn't realize that most women would rather go to an illegal abortionist than submit their problem to a panel of strange doctors and hospital administrators. There was little interest among women in their abortion and their organizations in the reform bills. I mention this in detail to give you some understanding of why outright repeal of the abortion laws was the only possible course for those of us who felt something had to be done, and also why it was the only bill that was sent to Governor Rockefeller for his signature. After the reform bills were defeated, I put in an outright bill. The governor was asked at one point whether he would sign it. It was reported to me that he indicated that he would sign any bill that improved the existing situation, which was so dangerous to the health of women and infants and so unfair to the poor. He was convinced of the justice of the proposal. From beginning to end, he never wavered. In spite of venomous attacks, he stuck by the decision he had reached conscientiously, I assume prayerfully. During this period, he gained my full respect and admiration. It was a very rough period. Would that more people in public office were willing to take difficult positions and stick with them.
Governor Rockefeller of New York, in his testimony before this committee, has supported liberal abortion laws. The Bible views abortion as the unlawful taking of human life or murder, contrary to the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. The unborn are regarded by God as being people, as is shown in Luke chapter 1, verse 44, where the unborn John the Baptist is described as leaping for joy when his mother was in the presence of the Virgin Mary, who was carrying the unborn baby Jesus in her womb. Again, in Psalm 51, verse 5, King David speaks of himself as being a person, not a thing, even from the time of his conception, when he says, "Behold, I was shaped in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." David uses the personal pronoun me, and not the impersonal it, to refer to himself in his former status as an unborn baby. As an advocate of liberalized abortion, Governor Rockefeller is morally unqualified to be president of the United States according to the Bible.
Well, as you have seen, abortion obviously is an emotional issue, and it's a controversy which is now spread beyond the borders of New York to the entire country. I'd like to turn now to Alan Campbell and ask you, Alan, what persuaded Mr. Rockefeller to embrace his liberal stand on abortion?
I'm not sure that I can give an answer of the thinking which went on in his own mind, but I do think that the issue was one in which the governor applied what has, I believe, long been his part of his political philosophy, which is a belief in individual rights, a belief in the protection of those rights, even though he combines that with a variety of conservative views which one might put under the law and order category. I would also add that the character of this issue is of a kind that causes politicians to do their best to avoid it, because it's a no-win issue. It's inevitable that whichever side you take, you're going to be hurt on the issue. And you've noted that as soon as the witness indicated that the vote in the Senate and House on the confirmation would be a referendum on abortion, that immediately he was taken to task for this by Senator Cannon and, I believe, Senator Griffin, because they don't want it to be a referendum on the question of abortion in any way. And it is, again, illustration of the character of the issue, and it was a very difficult issue for the governor as it was for the state legislature.
Dick Reeves, you heard one of the witnesses before the committee describe Mr. Rockefeller as the leading opponent or the leading supporter of permissive abortion in this country. Is he indeed the leading supporter of permissive abortion?
No, I think he was the governor of New York. People refer to New York as a liberal state. That doesn't mean that every voter in New York is liberal. It probably means that there is a strong, vocal liberal element that makes itself felt on every issue. And I wonder whether any governor of New York could have done otherwise, because what would have happened would have been things like large numbers of women publicly announcing that they had had abortions and defying the governor, the government, to arrest them for it and put them in jail. And I mean prominent women.
Are you suggesting then that political pressures induced him more than anything else to support abortion? You disagree with Alan Campbell on that?
No, like Scotty, I don't know what was in the governor's mind and how his own personal beliefs came to bear, because he is a product of a very religious background himself. I would add that Nelson Rockefeller, one of the things his money has always been able to do for him is allow him to take almost weekly polls in the state of New York, at least allow him to do it while he was governor. And in fact, abortion is about a 2-to-1 issue, pro-abortion, in the state of New York. Even many people who are personally opposed to abortion take the position that it is not their right to decide whether other people have the right to them. So that, I would guess that it was a situation where his own moral bearings and the political situation happily coincided in an unhappy situation.
Dave Broder, how does Mr. Rockefeller's position on this differ from that of Mr. Ford?
Well, Mr. Ford has expressed his personal opposition to the degree of permissiveness in the Supreme Court ruling on this decision. There seems to be a dispute, as we know, within the Ford family on this issue. Few of the prominent politicians have taken as advanced a position as Nelson Rockefeller has, but it may just be because, as Dick Reeves suggests, this issue comes to the fore in the state of New York. One other thing that I think we shouldn't forget, several of the witnesses mentioned this as a public health problem. And you also have to remember that Rockefeller comes out of the background of a governorship, where he has some responsibility for public health problems, as the senators, who, as Scotty pointed out, didn't want to get anywhere drawn into this controversy, really do not have in a personal sense.
One witness praised Mr. Rockefeller, one woman witness, because she said he had associated himself with the problems of the great silent majority in this country, namely women. Now, as we know, women are divided on this, but looking at it nationally, Dave, do you think it is more to a politician's advantage, nationally speaking, to support liberalized abortion these days?
It probably is in a public opinion poll sense, but it's also true that you thereby bring on yourself the aroused opposition of those who, from a very strong moral point of view, as we heard, take a diametrically anti-abortion position in this thing. And Rockefeller obviously has brought down that opposition from women and men who feel that way on a moral basis.
The point Dave makes keeps coming back in these hearings and kind of stuns the senators. Nelson Rockefeller was the governor of New York for 15 years. He could not dodge the abortion issue. There was no way. He had to come down on one side or another, either sign or veto the bills that were coming out. The senators obviously were perfectly willing to dodge the question if they can.
And also, as Senator Griffin suggested, though, he was divorcing Mr. Rockefeller's nomination from the issue of abortion. Well, now moving on to a third area of controversy. Much of the opposition dwelled on Mr. Rockefeller's handling of the Attica prison revolt in 1971, a revolt in which 43 persons died. Even some Rockefeller supporters see Attica as the great stain on his record. Mr. Rockefeller defended his dispatch of state troopers into the prison to quell the uprising, suggesting the demands for reform had turned into a political demonstration and were unwarranted. But critics said Mr. Rockefeller acted without regard to human life. The highlight came when Angela Davis, the black activist scholar, testified at the Senate hearings. She compared Mr. Rockefeller's refusal to grant amnesty to the rebellious prisoners with his endorsement of a pardon for former President Nixon.
Your hands on top of your head and move to the outside of the D and 3D block corridor.
Now, as early as July 2nd, 1971, the State Administration of New York knew that there were myriad problems at Attica. Prison Commissioner Russell G. Oswald received a communication from the prisoners with a list of grievances, most of which, the McKay Commission's report stated, were strikingly reasonable. The prisoners demanded legal representation before the parole board. They talked about improvement of medical care, visiting facilities, improved food, more sanitary conditions in the mess hall, better personal hygiene, clothing, recreational facilities, and more humane working conditions in the shop. They wanted a uniform set of rules in all prisons. They wanted adjustment of commissary prices and an end to the segregation of prisoners from the mainline population because of their political beliefs. Governor Rockefeller received a copy of that letter. His response, however, was silence. And it was for those things that the men at Attica rose up on September 9th. When, in the course of the uprising, the negotiations had reached a standstill, the men even surrendered those demands for a more human environment at Attica and asked only that they not be subjected to reprimands for their efforts to speak publicly about their sufferings and their grievances. The most powerful man in New York State, Governor Rockefeller, turned a deaf ear and permitted state police and prison guards to stage one of the most wanton massacres in the history of the United States. And I think that we have every reason to conclude that Governor Rockefeller's view of justice depends on the color of a person's skin and his economic status in life.
I'm asking for your opinion. I think you've given it, that you do support, you do believe that the inmates were right in demanding safe conduct to an anti-imperialist country.
Well, as I said, the key demand was the demand for amnesty. I understand the reasons behind the demand for safe conduct. I do not know whether that was a realistic demand within the context of the revolt which took place. But I do feel very strongly that had Governor Rockefeller intervened and guaranteed the prisoners immunity from prosecution, that the bloodbath, and of course, had he not permitted the state police, the National Guardsmen, the prison guards to go in with the massive force with which they attacked the prisoners, then those 43 lives would not have been lost.
Rockefeller's wrongful exercise or his failure to exercise executive authority in the handling of Attica has been further compounded by his massive attempt in the last 3 years at a cover-up designed to shield those in officialdom responsible for the murderous assault that claimed the lives of inmates, guards, and civilian employees. Though every official investigation since September 1971 has documented the wide-scale governmental lawlessness in connection with the handling of the Attica Rebellion, Rockefeller has engaged in continuous efforts to justify the assault over which he presided and to whitewash the serious breaches of law and of faith committed by himself and his agents. The tragedy of Attica continues. Through his appointment of a special prosecutor and through the illegal use of the statewide organized crime task force, Rockefeller has mounted and maintained a set of prosecutions against the primary victims of the Attica tragedy, the Attica inmates. His special prosecutor has obtained not a single indictment against a state official in connection with Attica, while 62 Attica brothers have been charged in some 42 indictments, facing some 1,400 felony counts and collectively some 40,000 years in prison. These Rockefeller prosecutions have been tainted throughout with serious illegalities and are being continued today despite the racially exclusive, biased nature of the grand jury that returned these indictments, despite the willful withholding by the prosecution of information necessary for the defense, despite the gross unfairness of appropriating millions of tax dollars for the prosecution while providing not one dime for the defense.
I am telling you that the governor of New York State premeditatedly, knowing that they was not going to do anything, let us stay in that yard and rap and rap and talk and then set up the assault force, and they came in that yard indiscriminately shooting. and all of this about some inmate snatching some gun, this was highly impossible. He was fined from helicopters, fined from roofs, 200 yards away from where any inmate could possibly put his hand on anyone. I'm not telling you about a McKay report. I'm not telling you about what Rockefeller said. I'm telling you about what I know, and I'm willing to deal with that at any given time with Rockefeller on that issue.
He finally agreed to the demands negotiated relating to reform. At which point, the spokesman for the prisoners said, in addition to these reform demands, in addition, we want a total amnesty, and we want free passage to a non-fascist, non-imperialist country. In my opinion, this was the clear indication of the turning point from reform to a politicized operation which was unrelated to the nature of what the uprising had been billed, in other words, as a prison reform uprising, and now became a political demonstration. At that point, there were further discussions held, and members of the committee went back. One by one, they left this advisory committee, fearing their lives, and the only man who was left who had the courage to stay and to argue with the prisoners was Mr. Clarence Jones of the Amsterdam News, who stayed on in to try and convince these people that it was in their interest to accept what they had achieved in the way of agreements on reform. He was unsuccessful and he came out. Now, I have to say that personally, I have a very strong feeling that if democracy is to survive, if free government is to survive in our country and in the world, that it cannot be run by individual citizens, whether, as in this case, some 82 or 3 of them were there as life for life on murder charges. We had abolished the death penalty. Whether the demands are made by prisoners or by other citizens, holding hostages with the threat to kill the hostages if their demands are not met, demands which are extra-legal, which are outside the law. And when this was added, that they wanted total amnesty and also free passage to a non-imperialist country, after talking with members of the committee who requested that I come to the scene, I do not believe in negotiating with people who are holding hostages as threat of death. I don't think that this is in the purview of a government to recognize that kind of action. So I issued a statement. Well, I asked the members of the committee who called and said that they thought I should come up, and I said, do you agree that we cannot go, or do you think we can go beyond what has been agreed to? And they said, no. Do you think we can provide amnesty? And they said, no. I just wanted to get their opinions. I knew we couldn't. Under the Constitution of the State of New York, you're not allowed to give amnesty under those circumstances. And I would not, as I said in my statement later, even if I could have. I did not believe that this was the way to defend the interests of a free society. I've taken the oath of office to protect the interests of the people, and I did not think that conformed to it.
Well, Attica certainly is one of those controversies destined to live long after the man. Dick Reeves, one of the things which Angela Davis said in her testimony was that this was one of the most wanton massacres in American history. What is your opinion?
Well, I don't want to associate myself with her words. I think that Rockefeller did make a calculated decision to go in there and use force. I am very, very cynical about his testimony on this and his talk of... He never said he regretted it. He said he regretted it happened. I remember going through the 1968 garbage strike in which...
In New York City.
In New York City, in which John Lindsay asked Rockefeller to send in the National Guard to collect garbage. And at that time, very emotionally, Rockefeller said that he could not do that and that he had tearfully, he had cried in considering it because his father had ordered armed troops into Ludlow, Colorado, and 19 people had been killed, 19 miners and their families, and that he then said in 1968 he would be incapable of duplicating anything like that action. But he did duplicate that action and went it a lot further, and I think he did it because he thought it was the right thing to do, that order is what holds a society together. And I am cynical enough to think that he does not regret it, because I think that incident is what made him acceptable to the conservative wing of the Republican Party. He paid his dues in blood, other people's blood, and they would have never believed his rhetoric, but they believe that action.
Alan, do you feel that he has any regrets?
Yeah, I think he does. He later said in testimony that if he had to do it again, he would do it without armed, without armed troops or armed policemen. And I do feel that he did think that there was no way, in terms of the negotiations which were taking place, that he could grant more than had been granted by the committee, and that if he went to the negotiations themselves, he would be placed in a situation where he would have to say no, and as the top man, saying no in that situation would have created an impasse that he couldn't have dealt with. Frankly, I think it unfortunate he did not go. I think it unfortunate that he did not make the final offer, and that if he had, it might have come out differently. I certainly do not agree, and I don't think Dick is really saying that it was a calculated thing in order to win the support of the right wing of the Republican Party.
No,
it may have come out that way.
No, no.
But that was hardly the intent.
No, no, I think it was a calculated decision in the sense that he thought society was best served by taking firm action in that situation.
Was it, as the governor himself suggested, on the part of the prisoners, was it a politicized operation?
And yes, it was, and increasingly politicized as it went along, as people who had some background in kind of radical politics and radical rhetoric took control of the rhetoric that was coming out of the prison. Yes, it was, but it was not a revolution in the sense that the society at large had to fear these people. I'd also say that one of the things that makes me cynical is the fact that people who were there, or people who have read a great deal about that incident, find it very hard to accept the version of that incident that Rockefeller testified to at these hearings.
In any event, it had no apparent impact on the senators insofar as confirmation of Mr. Rockefeller is concerned.
I don't think it had any impact at all.
I'd like to ask you, Dave, in a kind of perverse way, some politicians, it seems to me, looked more favorably upon Rockefeller because of what happened at Attica. True?
I think that is true. And that action, along with his much advertised welfare crackdown and the tough drug laws, and on those latter two, Scotty, there's no question was deliberately exploiting them to play to a conservative Republican audience nationally. All of these were part of what seemed to us as outsiders, non-New Yorkers, is a very deliberate attempt on Rockefeller's part to put himself in a better posture to compete for the 1976 Republican presidential nomination. So whatever motivated his actions at Attica, I think he was, I'd be with Dick in saying that he was quite willing to accept what he regarded as the beneficial political consequences of those actions.
But you certainly wouldn't suggest that he deliberately let Attica happen, hoping that it would help him in 1976.
And I'm not about never having been there to second-guess him. What I think one can say is that if Rockefeller's handling of that situation was right, then a great many other governors and mayors who confronted parallel situations were almost entirely wrong in the way they did it, because they used quite different tactics. They involved themselves personally, and in many cases they resolved the situation without the kind of bloodshed that occurred at Attica.
Another thing which Miss Davis said, Alan, was that his sense of justice depends on the color of one's skin and one's economic status. Is there any validity to that argument?
Now, I would argue that that is clearly not the case on the record, that if you examine the legislation in New York State while Rockefeller was governor, that you will find New York State had the first anti-discrimination legislation in housing, that the Medicaid program was the largest in the country. It practically broke the back of the federal government because of the effectiveness of the Albany bureaucrats in getting money for the Medicaid program, as well as for the other social welfare programs. The effort at the Urban Development Corporation to try to get around local fights against housing in suburban jurisdictions, it seems to me, are all evidence that the governor did listen to what his mother said, as was indicated in his testimony, that I have never found a bit of prejudice in the man in that sense, either economic or racial.
What about in the area of penal reform?
Well, you see, that's the interesting question in terms of Attica. The commissioner of corrections at the time of the Attica incident had been hired by Rockefeller as a prison reform man, and his record had been that of a prison reform man. And the reason for the appointment in the governor's own terms was for this purpose. Now, it's very hard to reform prisons because it's very difficult to get a political constituency to support reforming prisons. Who's going to vote for you because you reform prisons? And in that sense, it's in my judgment, is one of the most difficult issues that we face in this country, and the one where perhaps the greatest amount of injustice goes on after the justice system has supposedly worked itself out. So in that sense, the Rockefeller's efforts at prison reform were a failure, just as most prison reforms across the country have been failures because there is no political constituency to support prison reform.
But you see Attica as largely an aberration in the Rockefeller record.
Well, you see, that's the interesting question in terms of Attica. The commissioner of corrections at the time of the Attica incident had been hired by Rockefeller as a prison reform man, and his record had been that of a prison reform man. And the reason for the appointment in the governor's own terms was for this purpose. Now, it's very hard to reform prisons because it's very difficult to get a political constituency to support reforming prisons. Who's going to vote for you because you reform prisons? And in that sense, it's in my judgment, is one of the most difficult issues that we face in this country, and the one where perhaps the greatest amount of injustice goes on after the justice system has supposedly worked itself out. So in that sense, the Rockefeller's efforts at prison reform were a failure, just as most prison reforms across the country have been failures because there is no political constituency to support prison reform.
But you see Attica as largely an aberration in the Rockefeller record.
In relationship, if you're going to interpret it as evidence of being racially prejudiced or against the economic poor, yes. If you see it in relation to the governor's strong stance for law and order, then no, it is not, because he does have that strange combination in his own thinking. And let me say, I say these things as one who comes to this as a Democrat who has worked for candidates that have opposed the governor. Oftentimes after doing so, I ended up voting for the governor.
But you also worked for the governor.
Yes, but I've also, and the governor has been very open in that regard. I like to think he goes to talent wherever he finds it.
And he obviously finds it in many places.
Yes.
Well, despite Attica, Mr. Rockefeller always has had the support of minority group leaders, especially many prominent blacks. More so, of course, before Attica, but also after Attica. Nonetheless, at this week's hearings, there were black spokesmen who showed up to put in a good word and to say they felt he would make an outstanding vice president because of his record in New York.
I have requested an opportunity to testify before your committee in connection with the nomination of Governor Nelson Rockefeller for the office of vice president in order to place on the record a strong, categorical, unequivocal endorsement of his nomination by citizens who know of his good work and consistent support of OIC, the Urban League, and other community-based organizations in the state of New York and throughout the nation that work to eliminate poverty and racial inequity by promoting job training, job development, and economic development that helps people help themselves. I testify as a longtime resident of New York State, where Mr. Rockefeller has served as governor for 12 years, and I testify as a 30-year veteran civil rights activist who attended college in New York, fought the battles for economic equality and political power in New York's Harlem with the late Congressman Adam Powell, and subsequently with Borough President Percy Sutton and Congressman Charles Rangel, whose unquestioned political leadership among black people has always recognized and respected the leadership ability and the achievements of Nelson Rockefeller. I mention my personal background simply to indicate that I have been in a position to observe and evaluate the efforts that this man has made to change conditions in the cities and counties, the ghettos and barrios, and urban centers from the way they are to the way they ought to be. It has been my privilege to watch him try as a citizen, a presidential appointee, a governor, to come down on the side of equity as far as the race question is concerned in the areas of economics and politics. Like most black Americans, I have been grateful to him as I have watched the long-time commitment of his family and the Rockefeller Foundation to the black educational institutions, especially the Negro colleges in the South, such as Spelman College in the Atlanta, Georgia University complex, where his own mother made such a significant contribution.
As a concerned member of a minority race, and with over 20 years of personal experience with problems unique to urban areas, and the council of which I am chairman, consisting of black Republicans from several states, we urge his confirmation on the basis of his record as an administrator. Nelson Rockefeller served as governor of the most heavily urbanized state in the United States for 15 years. In New York, he met the monumental challenges facing all urban America with determination, energy, creativity, and considerable success. Nelson Rockefeller successfully proposed the first state government program in modern times to save urban mass transportation. Under his $2.5 billion transportation bond issue, the first new construction of New York City subways was started in nearly 40 years. Every commuter railroad in metropolitan New York is being rebuilt. He took action to hold the subway fare at 35 cents when it was surely headed to 50 or 60 cents, a potential disaster for working families. Housing is another epic challenge in the deteriorating inner cities. Nelson Rockefeller met this challenge, too, with energy and imagination. He created the Holy New Urban Development Corporation, which has completed or begun some 30,000 homes and apartments in over 35 cities, most of these homes for low and moderate income families. He had another 88,000 housing units started through the State Division of Housing and Community Development, again, largely for low-income city families. And I might add that under Nelson Rockefeller, New York State enacted a virtual total ban on discrimination in the sale or rental of housing and outlawed the vicious practice of blockbusting long before the passage of the National Fair Housing Law.
Dick Reeves, what was the meaning of these endorsements from black leaders?
Well, the fact that Rockefeller is perceived by large segments of the black community, particularly middle-class black community, as one of the great friends of black people in the country. He has run better in New York, getting something like 40% of the vote most of the time among black voters than any Republican, including John Lindsay, ever did. Lindsay ran better than him when Lindsay ran as a Democrat, but never as a Republican. And you see in the hearings that not only... what you see in the hearings is more a division in black perception than in Rockefeller's record, I think. He is a man of his time, and I think that younger blacks see that goodwill toward black people as being a kind of paternalism, perhaps designed to protect the society at large. But people like the ones who testified don't. They see the Rockefeller family as genuine friends.
Well, in the light of what Dick just said, Alan, would you then say that Attica didn't have a far-reaching impact on blacks who had supported the governor?
Well, that's a tough question. I would guess that Dick is quite right. It is middle-aged and to some degree middle-income or lower-middle-income blacks who have traditionally supported the governor. And certainly it is true that to some extent when the governor talks at town meetings and elsewhere about what he has done, there is a kind of paternalism about it in relationship to the Puerto Rican population and the black population. And there's no question that young blacks bristle at that. And I think that to the extent he has been hurt in the black community in relation to Attica, and I would argue that he has. It is among younger blacks and the more active militant blacks than it is in the mainstream of the of at least the growing lower middle income black community.
But still, in the black middle class, which obviously is a growing voting contingent, Rockefeller has continued to enjoy strong support.
He has.
Right. And Dave, let me put the question to you about how Rockefeller may help the Republican Party nationally in this area.
Well, he gives them some very obvious things. A vivid personality who can draw crowds, raise money. He gives them entree into a number of constituencies, including the black community, Spanish-speaking community, labor, which they've had very few avenues into in their recent history. He brings talent of his own. He brings talent that has been with him in the past.
Is this something which the blacks recognize?
Sure. Yes, I think so, and it's, I think, welcome. We have the Black Political Caucus meeting in Washington this weekend. I'd be very surprised if you don't have out of that group some expressions of interest in working with Rockefeller and exploring what's in it for them in playing this game as against the Democratic game, to see, not because they're about to drop the Democratic Party and become en masse Republicans, which they're obviously not, but because it's additional leverage for their own interests. But that's in the interest of the country as well.
Was there any significance in the endorsement of Shirley Chisholm for Mr. Rockefeller?
You want a cynical New York answer?
I'd like a very honest answer.
Any New York politician who has had to do fundraising and other things like that, while Nelson Rockefeller's people still control the governor's office, the special prosecutor's office, and the Manhattan District Attorney's office, all of which they do control, would be very foolish to get too rough with Nelson Rockefeller.
Well, there was one group of witnesses that presented an almost solid front of support for Mr. Rockefeller. The members of Congress who testified on Wednesday and Thursday. There were 11 of them, all but two Republicans, almost all conservative, and all but one strongly for Mr. Rockefeller. The Republicans were led by the Dean of the Senate, Vermont's George Aiken, who was followed in the witness chair by Senator Roman Ruska of Nebraska. And there you see Mr. Ruska, Senator Jennings Randolph, a West Virginia Democrat, House Minority Leader John Rhodes, Senator John Tower, Texas Republican, GOP Senator Clifford Hansen of Wyoming, Democratic Representative Robert Jones of Alabama, GOP Representative Howard Robeson of New York, Republican Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, Representative John Anderson, Republican from Illinois. Only GOP Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina questioned the nomination on the basis of economic concentration and the abortion decision. So, gentlemen, it does appear that the Republicans have now closed ranks. And for a final discussion, I would like to turn first to David Broder and ask you, David, how much help do you think Mr. Rockefeller is going to provide Mr. Ford and to the Republican Party?
Well, we don't know too much about what he's going to do in the administration, but it seems to me, Paul, that implicit in the choice of Nelson Rockefeller as the vice president was a recognition on the part of Mr. Ford that this was not in the ordinary vein of vice presidential nominations or selections. I just can't believe he's going to wear Rockefeller as a watch fob. I think he's going to put him to work both politically and administratively. And I would have to say that off of the record that Nelson Rockefeller has, which is one of the longest records in American public affairs, you've got to believe that this man is going to make an impact, and a significant impact, in the next 2 years.
Well, precisely how? Let's go a bit further and explore that, Dave. Just how do you think Mr. Ford is going to use Mr. Rockefeller to benefit the administration, to benefit the government, to benefit the Republican Party?
Well, there have been some suggestions from people who are, in the phrase, close to the president. But there are at least two areas that have already been laid out, which they'd like to see him move into. With his close friend and longtime associate, Henry Kissinger, he could work effectively, they believe, as a diplomatic troubleshooter. It's a big world. Kissinger cannot cover all of the bases and all of the kind of tension points, Mr. Ford wants to work and has to work primarily on the domestic problem and the economic problem. That leaves an obvious role for Nelson Rockefeller as a high-level emissary and negotiator for the United States.
Are you saying that this goes beyond mere goodwill missions to Uganda?
Yes, I think it goes well beyond that and probably takes him right into some of the toughest substantive issues in foreign policy.
Now, what about the domestic area?
Well, what's being talked about there is not really as much an operating role as a kind of a planning role. And one man in the administration has suggested that it might be very useful if Mr. Rockefeller brought into the government in some form the Commission on Critical Choices, which he had set up during this past year when he was temporarily out of public office, and use it as a device to give the government some capability for forward planning. As an example, that this man suggested on the question of how do you define the trade-offs between environmental protection and necessary developmental growth over the next decade or two decades in the United States.
In any event, what you're saying, Dave, is that the White House is now thinking of using Mr. Rockefeller in a forward-looking way.
In formulating policy. Another area that's obviously well within his background and competence would be in the whole area of federal, state, and local relations. He literally wrote the book on federalism.
That's right.
And if Mr. Ford is going to attempt to revive that idea, which was a central idea but not a very well developed idea in the Nixon administration, there's nobody who's better equipped to help give it political meaning and political muscle than Nelson Rockefeller.
Dick, there are some people who fear that Mr. Rockefeller may turn the number two job into the number one job, becoming an especially big banana. do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is I don't think that can be done. The President of the United States is the President of the United States. And I also think that I have... There was a point in my career where Rockefeller and I used to talk privately a good deal, and I was always impressed with his awe for the presidency and his respect for the office. His views on law and order go that far. And at that time, he very, very much disliked Richard Nixon, who was the incumbent, but would support him in public no matter how much in private he would talk about what a fool he thought Nixon was.
But given the fact that he's had such enormous power in New York, as every New York governor does, can he now sublimate himself in working for Gerald Ford in a subordinate capacity, even if he has major assignments?
He can go to Coney Island and look like one of the boys. He can play this role, too. And I think he will play it rather well.
Mm-hmm. Barry Goldwater has suggested, Dave, to come back to the political situation, that Mr. Ford might decide to drop Mr. Rockefeller in 1976 because he doesn't unify the party that much. Do you think there's any chance this might occur?
Well, nothing is impossible in politics, but I would guess that after you've given Nelson Rockefeller 9 months on the Republican chicken circuit and have let him raise money in 30 states, there's not going to be any great demand inside the Republican Party that he be replaced.
I think it has some interest, too, the range of senators that we just saw that endorsed the nomination of the governor, from Edward Brooke on one side of the spectrum to Senator Tower on the other side of the spectrum. I mean, I there's just no question that, assuming good health and other things, that the Republicans have their ticket for 76.
The Tower thing is interesting in light of Ronald Reagan, isn't it?
Sure.
Tower would appear in public,
yes,
for Rockefeller.
It is indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he also understands what's going to happen in 76.
Well, obviously, the Republicans are thinking about a winning ticket in 1976.
Right. Well, and they have a ticket there, which happens to include representatives of two of the big seven states and the two states that have been historically the most Democratic of the big seven. And if you confront the Democratic Party now with the problem of putting together a ticket against that can win 270 electoral votes without carrying Michigan or New York, you give them a fairly formidable political challenge.
Dick, you have made the point about how zestful Mr. Rockefeller still is, about how youthful he still is. Do you feel he still has his ambitions to be president one day?
He seems to have everything in working order, and I think his ambitions are in working order. There was a period in 1967 where he claimed he had lost his ambitions, and he would give long interviews about
the psychological change of life. And I remember talking to Bill Moyers about that at one point, and Moyers said, I believe Rocky when he says he's lost his ambitions. I also think he remembers where he put them. And I think Moyers would say the same thing today, and I think it's still true. I think the man wants to be president, and I think there's an awfully good chance he will be. I also think there is an increasing chance that Ford will not run.
Why do you feel that way?
I think that Ford is going to be in pretty bad shape by the end of the thing, and I don't think that it's unrelated to his own personality and the lack of arrogance, maybe the lack of need for this, and the fact that his wife went in the hospital tonight. I just have a gut feeling that at some point Ford is going to feel the best role he can play for himself and for his country is a transitional role, and then Nelson Rockefeller may be the beneficiary of that.
Well, Mr. Rockefeller would, in 1976, be 68 years old. Now, wouldn't that be a considerable age factor?
I think it depends entirely on whether it, in fact, shows itself, is that if he continues his current vigorous role, that the age, if anything, would be an asset. Let's remember that the age distribution in this country is changing. We are becoming every year an older nation. And just as with Abe Beame in New York, I think there was great satisfaction among people over 65 that they could vote for somebody over 65. And I'll say to the political analysts here, you better look at that issue.
We're entering the era of short and aged politicians. Is that
I'm not sure about the short, but I do think that maturity may suddenly become good politics again.
I have to say, Paul, that I think the scenario that Dick Reeves has sketched out is implausible, but I have learned through bitter experience not to disregard the hunches of New York political reporters. I recall very well in 1966 when Nelson Rockefeller announced categorically that he would not run for president again. Jim Desmond of the New York Daily News wrote a lead saying Nelson Rockefeller announced today that he would not run for president, comma, but he does not mean it.
I wish I had written that. All right, listen, I've gone down the tube with some implausible scenarios in the past.
Well, listen, there's another item here, too, and that is the Rockefeller style and how that will go over in Washington. Somebody said, for example, that he has eaten enough hot dogs to feed an army, and you referred to Coney Island earlier, Dick. How will this convivial, high feller style, how's that going to go over in Washington?
You know, I'm the worst person here to answer that. This is a different kind of place. I think that Nelson Rockefeller style is like that joke about where does an 800-pound gorilla sleep, wherever he wants. Nelson Rockefeller can act any way he wants, and people will accept it because he's Nelson Rockefeller.
I think this does raise problems, though, because I agree with Dick about Rockefeller's willingness and capacity to subordinate himself. But at the same time, it's hard for me to see how his residents can avoid becoming, in this wicked city, a kind of a second court. And there will be people who will cluster around Rockefeller. And it would be remarkable, given the talent for gossip and pettiness in this town, if there were not quickly out of that Rockefeller circle the kind of sniping at Ford and the Ford people that almost always takes place between a president and a vice presidential circle.
Yeah, I think Ford personally can handle that. But his staff, of course, will be backbiting and defending, I think, almost from the beginning.
And the issue isn't really, I don't believe, style in the sense of hot dog eating and so forth. The issue will come out of the governor wanting to do things. He is a man who likes to build things, as we in New York know, who paid the taxes for him. He is, as a politician, of the politicians I've known, I've known none who have the kind of interest in debating public policy issues, deciding on a program, and then doing it. And he does his homework. He does know the issues. And in that sense, there will be a kind of competing intellectual center, at any rate, in Washington. And I think the question really is the degree to which that can be done under the Ford umbrella and the degree to which it may become a separate show out on the side that you people will write about. And well, and help to bring to the public's attention.
Ford, of course, can send him on a world tour that'll take 3 months, too, if he finds it too aggravating.
But Dean Campbell used one phrase here that's very important, and that is that he said he's interested in debating and articulating and deciding issues.
Right. Yes.
And that's something that we have not had very much of in this town, and we probably cannot ever have too much of, is somebody who really is in there pushing to get action going.
And now we have that man, presumably, in Nelson Rockefeller, assuming that he is confirmed. Thank you, gentlemen, Mr. Reeves, Mr. Campbell, and Mr. Broder. As this week's hearings have shown, the Rockefeller record, in some ways, is a controversial one, but it's also one of achievement. And for that reason, barring some unexpected development, as I suggested a moment ago, he's certain to be confirmed as the 41st vice president. At the age of 66, when most people are retiring, it'll be a new life for the man who has aspired for so long to be the president. And while he never wanted the vice presidency, Nelson Rockefeller will now be closer than ever to the one job he has always cherished. I'm Paul Duke. Good night.
Washington, this has been a special summary report on the Senate confirmation hearings on Nelson Rockefeller to be vice president. Funding provided by public television stations, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This has been a production of NPACT, a division of GWETA.